This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today we'll continue our three-week keyboard run, going from the piano duo of Anderson and Rowe on last week's program to a single artist, whose name also begins with A, and a pianist that may be a new name for many of you, as he has spent the greater part of his career in the Washington, D.C. area, Michael Adcock. Studying at the Peabody Conservatory with Leon Fleischer, also earning degrees from the Oberlin Conservatory, Mr. Adcock now teaches and is an active participant in many festivals and chamber concerts. He won multiple prizes in piano competitions in the 1990s, giving his Carnegie Hall debut in 98. He has, in a relatively short time span, released his first two recordings on the Centaur label of not-so-Main Street piano repertoire. A recording dedicated to new and old rags called Ragtime in Washington, and a recording of piano transcriptions made by some of the great piano virtuosi. And from that, we're listening to Sergei Prokofiev's own piano transcription of music from his ballet Romeo and Juliet. My guest, Mr. Adcock, is performing appropriately for the onset of the program, the arrival of the guests, and then the music for the feuding Montagues and Capulets. I spoke with Michael Adcock by phone a few weeks back.
Thank you.
happy today to be speaking with pianist Michael Adcock. Well, I guess I should say congratulations, because at least within the span of a good calendar year kind of thing, you've had two new releases on the Centaur label. You've had a career that's spanned over 20 years professionally, and we'll get to what's on the recordings, but these are really the two first commercially released solo recordings. And I was wondering, why so long and why now to launch these recordings?
Sure, that's a great question. I did do an early recording in the early 2000s, but for various reasons I decided not to release it publicly, which had some more traditional repertoire on it. I think one of the reasons that these two kind of came within close proximity of one another, I've been primarily a chamber music pianist most of my life. I've always had a great love of chamber music, and I found myself playing mostly chamber music, even though I studied with wonderful teachers, and I studied and performed a lot of traditional solo repertoire. Just for some reason, it's never kind of went down that path. And then over the last maybe 5 or 7 years, I found myself wanting to do less chamber music, and oddly enough, and to play more solo literature for various reasons. And I've always been attracted to non-traditional piano repertoire. You know, I think someone could live 10 lives and just kind of barely, you know, the amount of classical solo piano literature there is.
Yeah, you have no shortage for your instrument.
Yeah, exactly. And even though there are still things to be said playing Beethoven, Mozart, Schubert, and those great piano composers, and Chopin, for some reason I tend to like more non-traditional repertoire. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, before we get to what's on the recordings, I mean, your career has basically been made south of where we are, in the Washington, D.C., and even in the Florida region. But maybe give us some background where you actually hail from, and then how did the piano get into your life, and how do you make that decision that it's going to be your career instrument?
Sure. I'm from Southern Virginia, a small town called Danville, which is on the border of Virginia and North Carolina line, which has the maybe dubious distinction of being the last capital of the Confederacy for about 6 months after Richmond burned. Given its size, though, it's a wonderful town and relatively cultured, and I had great training growing up. But then I went in high school to the North Carolina School of the Arts just to kind of have a more intensive focus on music, and that was a very sort of seminal period for me. It really got me, you know, hooked into being a serious classical musician. And then I went to Oberlin College after that, and then ended up at Peabody in Baltimore, where I was accepted by Leon Fleischer, who is a wonderful teacher, of course, and well-known musician. And I think that that was my preoccupation. There were times in my life, however, I doubted whether or not, you know, I should be a serious classical musician. I think I remember kind of quitting for a year just to kind of take a sabbatical for myself between degrees at Peabody, just to think a little bit about it. But of course, I always went back to it. And I've always been one of those musicians who's done a variety of things, some solo, some accompanying, some conducting, some choral literature, some chamber music, and teaching, of course, which to supplement my life as a musician, which we all need to do. And it's important, I think, in order to give back. But yeah, so it's always been all over the map.
But I mean, in the late 90s, you were winning awards, you made a Carnegie Hall debut, I mean, things like that. So, I mean, about 20 years ago, I mean, you knew this was going to be your career, but like you said, you're just picking which paths to go down and how to spend that time, whether it be a solo artist or something like that. Those are just decisions you just made.
I think because I can do a variety of things, I always sort of spread myself kind of thin. And anytime I try to focus specifically on one thing, I would always end up gravitating back toward the other thing for a little while and just kind of bouncing around. But now, for some reason, at this point in my life, now that I'm a little bit older, I sort of feel more compelled to be a solo pianist, oddly enough. It may even be kind of a backwards curve. I don't know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's kind of the reverse usually of a lot of pianists' career, where they're pushed out on stage alone for so many of their younger years. Turning once again to my guest Michael Adcock's recording titled Keyboard Transcriptions on the Centaur label, where he performs the seven virtuoso etudes by legendary pianist Earl Wilde arranging songs of George Gershwin, we'll hear Liza and Fascinating Rhythm. One of the recordings on Centaur is piano transcriptions, one piece by the composer himself and the others by great pianists, some of them pianists/composers.
Right.
I'm just curious on your choices on this recording. We'll talk about the transcription as a whole, but this covers a wide range of 19th century into the 20th. But you start off with the Prokofiev, which is Prokofiev's own piano version, but then go, well, just talk about the whole sequence of why you picked the pieces you did on this recording.
Yeah, I think I picked these pieces because these pieces were ones that I was attracted to and just motivated to learn and play. I mean, I've done a lot of transcriptions over the years, especially some of the more traditional transcriptions by Liszt and other composers who are pianist/composers. But I've always loved these Prokofiev arrangements, and I had learned maybe two or three of them, and I had also learned just two or three of the Gershwin Wild Etudes because they're, you know, a lot of fun and they're great encore pieces. And then I had performed at the conservatory where I teach in Washington. I do an annual recital, and I had been working on some of these transcriptions, just varied transcriptions over one summer. And I thought, well, maybe I'll make an interesting recital out of these pieces. And it turned out to be a big hit for me and also the audience, I think. And it was part of a Front Row Washington series on WETA. It was broadcast, and I got so much positive feedback, then I thought that I would fill in the pieces of both of those sets that I hadn't learned and maybe make a CD out of it. And then I thought, well, I got to have a couple more filler things that are a little bit more virtuosic and appealing that way to show off, I guess, technique and whatnot. So I tried to. That's why I added the Schumann and then the Horowitz arrangement of Carmen and then that wonderfully kind of hypnotic Gadowski Saint-Saëns piece, The Swan.
Well, you said how you sometimes don't go down, you know, the traditional piano repertoire route, I guess. And transcriptions have kind of always, you said, been in the mix of your recitals.
One of the things I think is most unique about the piano is that its ability to sound like other instruments and instruments of the orchestra. You know, you could argue that the organ is the king of instruments, but those are sounds that are, you know, pre-registered. And the piano, I remember studying with my last teacher, Ellen Mack, and every time I would play, she would say, well, it sounds like a piano. And that was a criticism,
yeah,
often, saying that it's not creative enough, the texture's enough, not varied enough, you haven't captured the essence of what that line could be. And I found myself teaching, too, beginning to ask my students, if you had to orchestrate this passage in your piano piece, which instruments of the orchestra would you pick and why, and how would you do that technically, and how would that sort of fire your imagination? And I think maybe that's one of the main reasons why I'm so attracted to keyboard transcriptions, just making the ability of the piano to sound like any instrument, the variety of textures.
Yeah, that kind of answered my, I was going to make you kind of defend the transcription, because, I mean, historically, the transcription exists. Like you said earlier, pianists wouldn't have to touch anything except music written specifically for the piano, and they can make
right,
a very
yeah,
fine career for themselves. But transcriptions existed, you know, originally in a time before recorded music, before people could readily get to the concert hall, symphonic hall, to hear some of these works, the opera house. So these were a way for people to hear these melodies, hear this music in basically their homes. You know, Liszt carries it to the next extreme. Just the use of their function and how you present them. So I guess it is all just about the fun of playing them, because at this time we don't need to hear, you know, we can hear these, not the way you have it, especially with the Earl Wilde pieces, but these pieces exist either as the composer wrote them or in other forces performing them. So this is really just the fun of playing them on the piano, some of it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But you could also, you could argue either way, I suppose, pro and con.
Yeah.
I also think that learning transcriptions has pedagogical, great pedagogical value for pianists, you know, and helps you become a better technician and a better musician when you play more traditional repertoire,
right,
as well, because it expands your technical arsenal, I suppose, and your ability to create color and variety of textures at the instrument.
Last question on these transcriptions. I've always wondered this and never really asked a pianist. If we put the Liszt aside, just because he's Franz Liszt, and the Prokofiev, I mean, Prokofiev was just a monster pianist. And so, you know, this is his music. He transcribed it for piano. But when you do these other transcriptions, which are really by people better known as incredibly virtuosic pianists, some of them the greatest pianists that ever lived, does that ever come into your mind that, I mean, this was transcribed by a pianist who is kind of, you know, one of those great pantheon of pianists, and then you're playing. I mean, I'm just curious, you know, that's...
Sure. I mean, it can be very intimidating. And when I was learning the Horowitz piece, I thought, you know, this is kind of in vogue right now, and all these wonderful young pianists are performing it in recital.
Yeah.
And will I get the license to put it on my CD, you know? and it's very intimidated. And then, you know, after I heard my recording, I thought, well, this is acceptable. I think I have something to say. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think if you approach great works of Beethoven, for example, with fear and trepidation, I mean, respect is one thing.
Right.
But if you approach any of these pieces with fear, then it's not going to happen for
right.
you. So I think you just have to have courage and to dive in. Sure, but I also feel as though that great tradition is something that's inspiring to me, that helps make me want to continue the tradition.
Yeah, I was just curious what that sort of pianist, I mean, in a weird way, it's kind of like maybe a jazz saxophonist, like, transcribes a great John Coltrane or Charlie Parker solo and then plays it. I mean, it's kind of,
yeah.
You know, there is that pianist playing. So I'm just curious.
Sure, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you can go and you can find a CD of that pianist playing it, and it will probably be, you know, better and more authentic. I don't know. But I'm sure that these composers, given if they were alive today, they would be thrilled that people
sure.
were performing their works. I mean, I think probably one of the more intimidating things is just that sometimes they're just so technically difficult and off the charts that you're working on them and you're thinking, you know, is the payoff worth the effort?
Right.
You have to ask yourself that. Now, will I get to where I need to be, where it sounds? Because I think as a pianist, when I perform, I never want it to sound like I'm struggling. And I have to get it to the point where, you know, it's facile and it sounds easy and, you know, it's convincing.
Yeah, and as much difficult virtuosic piano music as it is, sometimes the transcriptions are even harder because they weren't meant for the piano.
So, exactly.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Another dip into the Centaur recording titled Keyboard Transcriptions is made by my guest today. This, the great pianist Vladimir Horowitz's show-stopping Variations on a Theme from Bizet's Carmen, performed by Michael Adcock.
Thank you.
other recording takes us, just by its title, I mean, many pianists will include some of these pieces as encores or fillers. You devote an entire recording to a thoroughly American form. It could have only been given birth and existed here in the U.S. Though it's not always, but it's usually thought of as a piano-based form. Again, not always. Its history, though, is little known, probably by many, and sometimes romanticized. And I'm talking about ragtime. And we'll talk about what's on this, but I was wondering if you could just give us a little history, the history of ragtime, but then how that intersects with you, how the old and new that you have on this, how interested did you to really dive into this?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I grew up, I was a teenager in the 70s, so ragtime was very much in the popular sort of musical vernacular at that time.
Right.
You know, after the movie The Sting had been released and everyone was playing the entertainer in the Maple Leaf Rag, and
right.
That was a piece that would kind of get a teenager's attention, and I enjoy, and they were accessible to me at that time, and then over the years I've kind of learned and discovered more and more Joplin rags when I was in my 20s and 30s, and then began to come across other ragtime pieces by other seminal ragtime composers, such as the other ones on the CD, like Henry Lodge, those guys. And in the last 10 years, particularly, I've become acquainted with other 20th and 21st century composers that were greatly influenced by ragtime, such as William Albright and Bill Bolcom, and these particular kinds of composers. I thought it was very important that in the program notes, which I wrote for my CD, to talk a little bit about the history of ragtime. You know, it's kind of a unique and somewhat maybe paradoxical hybrid between this old vaudeville style of swung dotted rhythm, which was popular in the Mississippi Valley. But then it's combined with a more formal construct of a society hall dances and marches, which were prevalent in the South in the early part of the 20th century. And it was probably Scott Joplin, who, you know, was a classically trained musician, who really successfully fused these folk song elements with the European classical traditions, as well as the first ragtime musician to actually make money as a ragtime composer and have his pieces published. So that's how I see ragtime, as sort of a hybrid form of sorts.
Well, yeah, but it's got an interesting place in American history. It really was a musical form that broke down color barriers at a time when that was not the norm. And it really had, in comparison to things that came through it and out of it, had a very short lifespan. And I found that interesting in your notes as well. When you delve into it, and everybody thinks of Scott Joplin, but there were many African-American composers around Joplin writing rags. There were white composers writing rags. Just talk about how it sort of kind of fits in, you know?
Yeah, it does break through these sort of racial constructs. And a lot of these pieces, too, were, I think these guys all knew each other. You know, you could walk down the street and you would be in one sort of vaudeville hall, and then you could walk down the street and there would be another musician who you could recognize unmistakably. But not a lot of these pieces were published.
Right.
This was more of an improvisational kind of medium. But it had certain power. Yeah, it did sort of flame out. Thankfully, though, it's been kind of reinvigorated from time to time. But I don't think you really hear the music as much anymore. As you said, people might do a rag piece on as an encore from time to time, and some of these more modern rags that I'm talking about. The whole history of ragtime is very complex, and there are all sorts of merging currents at the time that sort of creep in. There's a little bit of swing. Then some people merge cakewalks and two-steps. There's even, in one of my pieces, even a piece that goes by the name of the Harlem Chicken Scratch. Some people merge ragtime with tango or other elements of Latin musical culture. Yeah.
Turning to my guest's other recently released CD on the Centaur label titled Ragtime in Washington, featuring old and new rags, we'll hear Scott Joplin's Palm Leaf Rag, followed by Bob Zirke, who lived a short life from 1912 to 1944. This is Old Tomcat on the Keys, performed by my guest today, Michael Adcock. Thank you. You devoted a whole disc to this. Like I said, some classical pianists have these in their repertoire, especially since it's been kept going by such well-known American composers like William Bolcom, his buddy at University of Michigan, William Albright, and then John Musto. They're all on the recording. Hate to ask this, but when you perform these in your recitals or such, does it still carry the stigma of kind of popular, lowbrowish type of music, lighthearted music, or what is its... Not in my experience.
I think people, there's sort of nostalgia about rags. Hmm. You have to be careful when you start talking about that. But I think that there are memories of certain aspects of the Old South that bring back nostalgia for people. And I think that it's like any other work of music or tradition of music. Anybody can play it. Music is music. I've had almost all positive reception to playing these pieces, whether it be Joplin or one of the more sophisticated contemporary rags. And I think people understand the history of the genre, even if they don't know all the details surrounding it. And so far, it's had a very positive response. I mean, I was actually encouraged when I was thinking about doing a ragtime CD of doing all the works of one composer. I think CD manufacturing, you know, distributors, they would prefer, and they think it perhaps sells better if it's all music of Bolcom or all music of Joplin. But right. That didn't interest me. I wanted to do something that was not exactly intentionally planned as a survey of ragtime, but to show a history, a little bit of ragtime and how it's developed over the last century.
Yeah, no, it's a great survey, and you don't have any on your disc, but I would encourage people also to check out this American composer named Judith Zamont, who also writes rags. So there are American composers, living and breathing, who are still very much into this form, and hopefully some younger ones will pick it up as well. I don't know if you've had anybody come up to you and say, hey, I'd love to write a rag for you or something like that.
Well, I've had a couple of rags that have been submitted, you know, and the one main living composer that I'm close to, which is on the CD, is probably Tom Benjamin, who was a colleague of mine at Peabody and was a mentor of mine for many, many years. And his rag is just so charming, and with the title, you know, that old Second Viennese School rag. And apparently it was a kind of a challenge piece from another composer saying, I don't think you could write LF 12 tone. He said, oh, yeah, watch me. So he said, sure, you can make anything sound 12 tone, any kind of style sound 12 tone.
Well, hats off to him for taking up the challenge. So here is that quote-unquote 12-tone rag by Thomas Benjamin, as performed by my guest today, Michael Adcock, from his recording titled Ragtime in Washington. This called That Old Second Viennese School Rag. My guest Michael Adcock's recording titled Ragtime in Washington contains modern rags by composers such as William Albright, William Bolcom, and here is In Stride by composer John Musto. Thank you. The CD is titled Ragtime in Washington, and obviously a lot of your career is there. Just to go back there, I mean, you do a lot of work, obviously, in D.C. and the Maryland area. We get a little New York Philly-centric up here, so I'm just wondering if what's happening down there that we up here should know about.
Well, I think Washington has become a more culturally sophisticated city over the last 20 years. You know, it's still the center of politics, for better or worse. But I noticed that, I mean, it's always been a cultured city, but in terms of there being kind of an artistic environment that was for musicians, not so sure. Probably Baltimore was a little bit more inclined with Peabody Conservatory, you know, affiliated. And
right.
D.C. does not have a formal training ground conservatory for college-age students, except, of course, the University of Maryland, which is in College Park.
Yeah.
And I've noticed over the last 20 years since I've been living here a lot more experimental trends in arts concerts and classical offerings coming up in a more coverage, you know, more specific coverage in paper for classical musicians and concerts.
We have a bi-monthly program called Post Classical, which features the Post Classical Ensemble, which is based out of Washington, D.C., and they're doing a lot of innovative things down there as well. What about you? What's ahead for you? So now that you've kind of said, hey, I could start recording solo recording discs,
yeah.
What's ahead for you?
Well, I'm on a roll. Actually, oddly enough, I just finished this weekend recording music of Spain and South America, or Latin America, I should say, which has also been another interest of mine. And I always love to record on the holiday weekends because there's not much going on. I don't have to compete with other kinds of noise. And it's a little early to say whether or not this is going to end up being a CD.
Right.
I have to see what the results are like and go to the editing stage. But I think I'm relatively happy with the results. And again, it's going to be one of those hodgepodge CDs of music that's inspired by Spanish and Latin American tradition. So it's going to be composers all over the map, living and, you know, not living.
Well, artists like yourself are real programmers, or people on the radio, or people doing what we do, love it because, you know, yes, everybody has something to say about Beethoven or Schubert or even Bach or whatever, but, you know, there's plenty of those recordings. It's always nice when you get recordings like you because you have something on there that we can figure out and say, oh, this is a nice find, or this would be great. It's always a great way to do that. Well, I wish you the best of success going forward, and I guess we'll just keep watching for the discs, hopefully, as long as CDs remain with us, or downloads, or whatever they turn to keep rolling out. I close my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests two questions, same two questions, and the first question's a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to talk with, but could. When I ask that, I'm just curious, what's the first name that pops in? Sometimes you get flooded if you think about it but too long, but when I ask
I would probably want to talk with either Franz Schubert or Rachmaninoff.
Okay.
Franz Schubert, you know, he lived so, he didn't hang around for a long time, unfortunately. And
no.
Just the fertile inspiration for his music, I would love to sit around and chat with him about that. And Rachmaninoff, for me, is more appealing as a pianist, just in terms of how he approached the instrument and also how he kind of got through some of his typical artist depression and how he handled some of those things.
Now, are your hands anywhere the size close to Rachmaninoff?
No, I have. I think I would have relatively average-sized hands. I think sometimes it's more the span. You know, they stretch out.
Right.
That's the fun party gimmick of mine whenever I'm with a cellist.
Yeah.
Ask any cellist to put their hands together, and it's remarkable because almost everyone, the left hand, you know, the hand that has to hunt on the fretboard for the pitches, is from the stretching. Years and years of stretching is a little bit longer than the bow hand, oddly enough. So I think that has more to do with it than just the length of the fingers. Yeah, I curse Rachmaninoff a lot.
Rachmaninoff,
saying, are you kidding me?
he would have been a frightening cellist if you ever played the instrument.
Exactly.
Final question. Final question is non-musical, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy not only recording and playing, but also teaching and everything you do down D.C. way. When you have to do something that is non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but if you need to get away, a little respite, what do you do?
Well, I have a gym goer, and I love to bike. Okay. In fact, I had a wonderful bike ride on Sunday, except that I had an accompanying bike accident, which I was really concerned about. I kind of hit a muddy patch and then wiped out. I don't think I've done that since I was a teenager. And I was a little worried because I had another day of recording to do, but I mostly just scraped up my elbow and knee. And when I'm not biking, I think I really enjoy cooking. It's a very relaxing pleasure of mine, and there's a wonderful creative element to cooking, which I think kind of goes hand in hand with being a musician.
And a safer activity than biking
most
of the time.
Yeah.
Michael Adcock, thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Pianist Michael Adcock. You can find out more about him at his website, Michael Adcock, A-D-C-O-C-K, piano, michaeladcockpiano.com. His two recordings, Ragtime in Washington and Keyboard Transcriptions, are on the Centaur label, distributed by Naxos. Check them out at naxos.com or centaurrecords.com. I'll leave you with the closing track from that Keyboard Transcriptions CD, the legendary pianist Leopold Godofsky's transcription of one of the movements from Camille Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals. This is The Swan, as performed by my guest today, Michael Adcock. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.